This is the Angry GM, and welcome to yet another The Angry GM's Proofread Aloud. And today we are proofreading aloud an article that is pedantically entitled The 5 Best and 5 Worst Things in D&D 3.5 According to Angry. A title I hate, but it's not going to get any better than that. So let's get reading. I keep this framed quote on my desk. Maybe you've heard it. It goes like this. In many ways, the work of a critic is easy. We risk very little, yet enjoy a position over those who offer up their work and their selves to our judgment. We thrive on negative criticism, which is fun to write and to read. But the bitter truth we critics must face is that, in the grand scheme of things, the average piece of junk is probably more meaningful than our criticism designating it so. That quote's there to remind me that I'm not a critic, and I don't want to be. I want to do something meaningful. I admit I do a lot of shit-talking, and I offer a lot of personal opinions, but I never do it for fun, never for cheap laughs. Okay, sometimes I do it for cheap laughs, and to needle internet gamers who take themselves too seriously to make fun of the things they love. I make fun of the things I love all the time, but I always try to offer something of value in return. That's my rule. Never tear something down without offering something of, without putting something up to replace it. Without putting something else up to replace it. That's how I wanted to say it. Okay. That's my rule. Never tear something down without putting something else up to replace it. Look, any idiot can break stuff down, and it's fun to do. But if it's all you do, you end up sitting bored in a room full of broken toys. And maybe the F-wits in Hollywood should remember that the next time they're deconstructing something or subverting expectations just to prove how much smarter they are than everyone else. If you're choosing misery over joy and a world of broken entertainment, how smart are you, really? With all of that said, let me present you the first of two clickbaity top and bottom five lists. Yay! The good, the bad, and the angry. With the year coming to an end and my gearing up to take my sight in a new direction, or to find my vision again, whatever, I want to have a little fun. So I'm engaging in the age-old internet commentator practice of publishing a list. No, two lists. Wait, four lists. Four whole lists of unfettered, unqualified, worthless opinions. Let me explain. For years, I've been playing, running, and writing about the latest incarnation of Dungeons & Dragons to hit store shelves, which it did 8 effing years ago now. During that time, I've had a lot to say about it, some of it good and some of it bad. And I've made it pretty clear I don't much care for D&D 5e in the grand scheme of D&D editions. Meanwhile, in the last year, I've switched my personal home games, somewhat inconsistent though they are, back to the greatest incarnation of Dungeons & Dragons to hit store shelves, which it did 20-something years ago, depending on what you count. During that time, I've had a lot to say about it, some of it good and some of it bad, and I've made it pretty clear that I very much love D&D 3E. Now, I'm a hyperbolic guy. Hyperbole is good for laughs, and it's good for winning fights on the internet because being right is less important than bullying people into quitting. Truth is, I don't really think 3E was sent by a heavenly host to save us all from bad games any more than I think D&D 5E emerged from the stinkiest part of Satan's hairy ass. But I want to give both editions a But I want to give both editions a really solid, if very subjective, look. Specifically, I want to offer up my list of five. I want to offer up my list of the 5 best and 5 worst things each edition has to offer. And I'm starting off with D&D 3E. Rules of the game. I was going to do this whole long speech about how all this crap is subjective, and I was going to explain all the weird little rules I followed when populating these lists, and explain my process. But you know what? F that. I'm just listing things. Whatever things I want to list for whatever reason. Just things that make me happy or make my blood boil. In no particular order. But I do have rules. For you. Two rules. First, If you want to add something or good or bad, something good or bad of your own, fine. That should be for you, you commentators, so that it's clear that I'm talking to people leaving comments. But I do have rules for you, you commentators. Two rules. First, if you want to add something or good or bad of your own, fine. But you must add one of each. If you add a good thing, you have to add a bad thing too, and vice versa. Any idiot can praise what they like and bash what they don't. Don't be any idiot. Second, no hearsay. If you ain't played or run D&D 3E, you've got nothing to say. Any idiot can parrot bullshit they read on Reddit, and any idiot can prejudge shit they've never touched. Don't be any idiot. Break my rules and I'm going to delete your comment and call you an... I miswrote that and said call me an idiot. That's really funny. Break my rules and I'm going to delete your comment and call you, not me, an idiot. And if you start an effing edition war, I will make you regret it. Got it? Good. I ain't effing around. The five best things in Dungeons & Dragons version 3.5. There's an extra period there that doesn't need to be. So what are the five best things about D&D 3E according to Angry? Here they are in random-ish order. Because Angry don't rank shit. These five things are all equally best as far as I'm concerned. How you roll. Fail by 5, take 10, and take 20. First, the thing you all knew was coming. Yeah, after I piled all that praise on the fail by 5 rule in that last article, you had to know it would be here. But it ain't alone, because fail by 5 was one of the three corollaries to the D&D 3E core mechanic that made that edition much less reliant on perfect GMing judgment. I ain't gonna explain the fail by 5 rule again, but I'll briefly explain take 10 and take 20. But if the, I need to fix that because I'm using two buts to start sentences. And then let's link those two sentences together and comma. Okay, I ain't gonna explain the fail by 5 rule again. I will briefly explain take 10 and take 20, but if the discussions in the Angry Supporter Discord channel are any indication, you probably won't grasp the subtle nuances that make those two rules such genius. The take 10 rule allowed a player to skip the die rolling part of any ability check if the situation wasn't particularly stressful. The character cleared their head, breathed, and took care in what they were doing because they didn't have stress weighing on them. And the player calculated the result as if they rolled a 10 on the d20. Simple. The take 20 rule allowed a player to skip the die rolling part of any ability check if they were willing to waste as much in-game time as was necessary to succeed. Taking 20 wasn't an option on any check that had some kind of cost or penalty for failure. As above, the player calculated their ability check result as if they'd rolled a 20 on the d20. Simple again. Taken together, fail by 5, take 10, and take 20 provided solid mechanical rules for skipping unnecessary die rolls and added stakes to the most stressful and dangerous of situations. Players could elect to settle for average results when that's all they needed, provided the stakes weren't too high. And players could always get the best possible result by spending inordinate amounts of in-game time, provided they weren't risking injury, death, or loss with every check. And thus, the GM's ability to wreck the game by calling for unnecessary die rolls was drastically reduced. There's a bunch of accidental italics here. I forgot to close a tag. There we go. Both D&D 4E and D&D 5E have experimented with different versions of these rules. But passive checks still don't count as a take 10 mechanic, and you sound like a moron when you suggest they do. 4E and 5E experimented with different versions of these rules, but both are missing key elements, and their implementations lack some of the nuances that made these three rules so powerful. I'm all for teaching GMs good judgment, but I prefer if good judgment ain't a prerequisite for not running a shit game. Hence, the need for solid rules that provide a good experience regardless of the GM's judgment. A world that makes sense, internal, mechanical, and flavorful consistency. D&D 3E was designed around universality. The designers wanted everything to work the same. That's how the D20 core mechanic came to exist. But it was also evident in how the same rules applied to everything in the world, and how much care went into figuring out how those rules represented the fiction of the world. Mostly. The clearest example of this is in Chapter 10 of the Dungeons & Dragons version 3.5 Player's Handbook. And again, I have an unnecessary period. The one... The clearest example of this is in Chapter 10 of the Dungeons & Dragons version 3.5 Player's Handbook, the chapter that fully explained how magic worked, not just mechanically, but fictionally as well. The rules explained what it meant to prepare spells, and why spells that a wizard wanted to cast twice had to be prepared twice. It explained what spell components were for, and it explained how spellcasting interacted with magical items. Hell, in the DMG, it explained why wizards and clerics invented the magical items they did, based on the limitations of their own magical systems. The consistency ensured the GM wasn't left in the dark to resolve weird rules interactions. GMs knew, for example, whether dark vision was magical and which monk abilities didn't work in anti-magic fields and shit like that. Moreover, it ensured that when a GM couldn't find the answer, or didn't want to waste time looking, the GM still understood the world well enough to figure out a good, consistent, logical answer. D&D 3.5 didn't have a lot of hand-waving. It never said, well, it's a magic fantasy world, so anything is possible. Strong creatures couldn't be as strong as the strongest humans, and if they were, magic was involved. Explicit magic. Magic that could be countered. Hell, there were a bunch of spells that existed solely so the GM could build magical effects into his adventures without having to hand-wave shit. Nothing was just fluff, and nothing was just crunch. If you knew the rules, you understood the world. If you understood the world, you knew the rules. Mostly. DIY bestiary. Monster customization. By today's standard, lots of D&D 3E's monsters look a little bland, especially the humanoids. D&D 3E just didn't have the focus on push-button special powers that 5E does. But what D&D 3E did have was the single most customizable bestiary ever. Say you wanted a giant toad for an adventure, but your high-level party was too tough for a giant toad. You could literally just advance the toad, or the chimera, or whatever. Make it bigger and more powerful. There was a systematic way to basically give every monster extra levels in its own species. Monsters with feats and equipment could be respec'd and re-equipped very easily to change their focus. And the monster... And the GM could give any intelligent monster levels in any class. Sure, the monster manual goblins are generic first-level mooks, but if you wanted a warchief or skulk or shaman, you could just slap a few class levels on one. Hell, there were even 5 different NPC classes that weren't quite as powerful as the normal character classes, but were perfect for customizing mooks with class-like abilities, as well as for statting up any town guards or bandits or healer priests you needed. Then there were templates. Everyone remembers templates. Take a monster, pick a template, follow the step-by-step process, and bam, you'd have a demonic monster, or an angelic monster, or an undead monster, or a half-dragon monster. Whatever. All of these options were spelled out in the monster manual alongside the build-your-own-monster-from-scratch rules, so the monster manual wasn't just a bestiary, but a fully customizable, do-it-yourself monster toolkit that didn't require you to buy a second book and then build every unique monster from scratch, or to ham-fistedly reskin shit and give it a different name. Zeros to heroes. Humble, low levels. I know some of you won't call this a good thing, and you're just effing wrong, but first-level characters in D&D 3E felt like first-level characters. They felt like neophytes, newbies, and greenhorns. Their skills, talents, abilities, and equipment were limited. They had room to grow and evolve. You don't get that same vibe from the more recent incarnations of D&D. Yes, low-level characters are still delicate, but delicate like a glass cannon is delicate. They're delicate superheroes. D&D 3E just didn't pile a lot of shit onto the character sheet, especially at low levels. Most classes only gained a modest number of special abilities throughout their career, and they had to wait for and earn their best stuff. But the stuff they did get was enough to make the class feel like whatever archetype it was supposed to. In D&D 3E, you can't start the game playing Aragorn, but you can play a character that feels like a teenage Aragorn. Yes, I know teenage Aragorn lived a century before the Lord of the Rings story. Shut up. The point is, in D&D 5E, you can start the game playing Aragorn, or at least Aragorn with hemophilia and that brittle bone disease. A full toolbox, the Dungeon Master's Guide. There's always fights over which D&D DMG is the best, but anyone who argues any DMG was better than the version 3.5 DMG either never read it or they're an idiot. This is the only thing on this list that ain't a matter of subjective opinion. It's a categorical, axiomatic, objective fact. The Dungeons & Dragons version 3.5 Dungeon Master's Guide is the best DMG ever published. It's amazing just how much shit is in there. Not pro shit, not advice shit. Actual useful game building tools. I mean, sure, it's got all the DMG staples about managing games and using rules and magical items, of course. But it also provides, for example, a survey of every major biome you might find on a D&D world map with descriptions of the features, hazards, and obstacles you might find in each. That includes the dungeon biome. There are extensive descriptions of the multitudes of terrain types, hazards, and features that litter the underground. There are tables of stats for every kind of NPC at every level you might need, complete enough that you could use those stats in a pinch to run the NPC at the table. You wouldn't, the tables were meant to help you build NPCs beforehand, but you could. There are pages of poisons, traps, and diseases, and detailed rules for building your own versions of each. There's an entire chapter dedicated to building and populating any kind of settlement in a fantasy world if you felt the need for that kind of exhaustive detail. And there are at least a dozen other useful things I've not listed. And there's a complete glossary of game terms and a fantastically complete index. You can accuse the D&D 3E DMG of being overstuffed, but I cannot think of one thing that should be in there that isn't, which is something I can't say about any other DMG that's ever been published for any edition of D&D. The D&D DMG also understands its tripartite role as an instruction manual, reference book, and toolbox fully and completely. Its presentation is top-notch. Honorable mention, opportunity attacks. I'm cheating a little, and I don't give a crap. I started writing this article by writing down as many bests and worsts as I could come up with off the top of my head. Then I pared each list down to five things. But there was one best I really wanted to include, but which wasn't quite big enough to qualify for such a list. But I want to talk about it anyway, and it's my list, so I'm gonna. D&D 3E had extensive attack of opportunity rules, and if I was making a list of super important mechanics that don't seem fun but can't be removed without breaking the game, opportunity attacks would top that list. In D&D 3E, if you did basically anything other than make a melee attack where another creature could slap you, they got to do just that. The rules were more detailed than that. I won't deny they were complex, but they all amounted to that. If you're in something's melee reach, make a melee attack or suffer the consequences. Opportunity attack rules fall into this broader class of rules called zone of control mechanics, and they're a mainstay of strategy and tactical games because they allow units to limit other units' options by being in the right place at the right time. And that's especially important in games that mix unit types, like, for example, melee ranged and magical units. Without robust zone of control rules, melee attackers lose their most important edge. That is, once a melee fighter's in your face, they're hard to deal with or escape from. D&D has worn down its opportunity attack rules because they're complicated and they're annoying and they lead to endless nitpicky square counting. They don't, by the way. It's GMs that create endless nitpicky square counting, but that's a story for another time. The problem is players are starting to notice that melee combat is the crappiest combat in D&D 5e. You're absolutely always better off having a bow and spell shootout than pulling a sword. And that means the only useful monsters are the ones with bows and spells too. Simply put, if you want a strategic and tactical combat game that mixes melee and ranged combat, and supposedly that's what D&D wants, you need robust zone of control mechanics. Letting fighters scowl at specific foes and dare them to attack, as a variant rule, ain't enough and it never will be. Melee fighters must exert strong, sticky, dangerous zones of control. The five worst things in Dungeons & Dragons version 3.5. The third edition may be the single best edition of Dungeons & Dragons ever published, but that doesn't mean it's a perfect game. Like every edition of D&D, it's got bugbears, and some of its bugbears get pretty big size modifiers. I gotta fix that, pretty big size modifiers. And while I'm at it, I also have to do that. Okay. Mapping progress, character planning bullshit. Stop me if you've heard this one. How do you make a first level character in D&D 3E? Make a 20th level character and then take their levels away. In D&D 3E, you started with a zero and made it a hero. You had to grow, but you were also discouraged from actually evolving. 3E offered lots of ways to customize your characters. You had feat trees, liberal multiclassing, which I loved and hated, and prestige classes. But every cool option had an endless list of prerequisites and requirements you had to meet. If you wasted one rank on the wrong skill, you might never qualify for that prestige class you wanted. Am I being hyperbolic? A little. It was totally possible to just build a fun character level by level. But once players got even a little experience with the system, the game pushed them toward planning their advancement levels in advance. It wasn't just the min-maxers and the delightful folks on the Karops board, it was everyone. Why? Well, it was down to two things, really. First, as I said, D&D 3E was very into its prerequisites and progressions. You had to spend a lot of resources on a lot of prerequisite shit to get the coolest toys. And second, some of the best fantasy archetypes were gated behind high-level prestige classes instead of being more freely available. If you wanted to play an effective squashbuckler, an actual draconic sorcerer, or any flavor of effective gish, a spell sword, a spell thief, or a spell bow, you had to wait through at least 6 levels and follow a very carefully planned progression scheme. And that sucked in a game that otherwise really hit the perfect balance of zero to hero. You now have 9 rounds to live. The death and dying rules. In D&D 3.5, you can have less than 0 hit points. You can have negative hit points, okay? And when you have negative hit points, you're unconscious and bleeding out, right? And when you reach negative 10 hit points, you're dead. Got it? Now, there are 2 consequences to this shit that by themselves aren't problems, but they became problems when you put them in the same game. At low levels, there wasn't much uncertainty about death. The death rules provided a very precise and very lenient timer. Your party had up to 10 rounds to save your dying ass. And because most fights rarely lasted more than 5 rounds, and because most people didn't go down in the first round, most players figured out they could safely ignore their dying allies until the fight was won. At high levels, given the damage a single powerful creature could dish out with one full attack action, an injured PC could go from conscious to dying to dead in the span of one monster's turn. That 10 hit point buffer wasn't enough to cushion a PC from high level damage. As I said, neither of those is inherently a problem. I find the first scenario's relaxed, casual attitude toward death, take your time, your dying friend will be fine for a while, a little lame, but it worked. But you can't have that attitude for a little while and then switch to a game in which every low health PC is one lucky hit from total existence failure. You can't have it both ways. Okay, for this next section, there is a cute little visual joke, and I'm going to make sure that the live chat can enjoy it. So at the appropriate time, I will be posting an image into the Discord, and those of you listening to the recording should just check it out, because I'm very proud of this one. Anyway, sip and then heading. Write the gross armor class from page 2, box 2, in box 13B, the character sheet. Okay, this is delivered as a series of dialogue. Hey, Alan, do you want to play this amazing freeform fantasy adventure game where you get to be a knight or a wizard or an elf and explore ruins and fight monsters and do literally anything you can imagine doing? Hell yes, that sounds awesome. Okay, here's your character sheet. I think I hear my mother calling me. And there's an image of the D&D 3.5 character sheet interspersed in there. Anyway, next heading. I will not make a grapple joke. Fiddly little minutia. D&D's 3rd edition had a lot of rules. A lot of tiny, fiddly little effing rules. Ignoring the fact that half of every PHB, I need to emphasize every or else it won't be clear the point I'm trying to make there. Okay, ignoring the fact that half of every PHB is devoted to its spell list, something like a third of the Dungeons & Dragons version 3.5 player's handbook was taken up by the effing skills chapter. And the skills chapter was 10% useful rules and 90% setting precise DCs for any imaginable situation that might come up in any fantasy ever, any fantasy adventure ever. Okay. Want to know the precise DC to tumble 1/2 speed without provoking opportunity attacks up a gravel-covered angled floor? It's 19. Want to know the exact number you need to roll to track a party of 7 ogres that passed through this forest 2 days ago, assuming it rained for 2 hours last night and the day's kind of foggy now? DC 17. Making an intimidate check to demoralize a young adult black dragon that just downed a potion of remove fear? That's an opposed check, and the dragon rolls d20 plus 21 against your intimidate check. I ain't complaining about the level of detail per se. It's actually nice to have a sense of what figures into the difficulty of a given task. The problem's more about the granularity. Most of the DCs fall into that nice, comfortable, easy, medium, hard, very hard, super ultra hard scale that goes up by 5 anyway, so it really wasn't worth calculating the precise DCs, and it was a pain in the ass. That's why GMs winged the DCs most of the time. But this ain't just about DC calculations. D&D 3.5 also had a lot of tiny little rules that were just super easy to forget during play. They were neat and included things like skill synergies and the dodge feat, but a rule you forget to use is a rule that doesn't exist. My one player and I are still forgetting about his damn dodge feat every session. I gotta fix that. There's a mistake in that. Yeah. Okay, my one player and I still forget about his damn dodge feat every session. Your anger meter is empty. X per day abilities. So D&D has got spells, right? And those are powered with spell slots, right? Which are either Vancian spell slots or more like mana points depending on the edition you're playing, right? In D&D 3.5, things were more Vancian, but as I mentioned, that was all worked into the world lore and the wizards made sense. I have zero problems with Vancian magic. In fact, I think the world was a better place before that at-will cantrip bullshit infected everything. But D&D's also got character abilities, right? Magical, supernatural, or exceptional things PCs can do that aren't spells. And those things have charges, right? They can be used a certain number of times each day or between rests or whatever. Barbarians just can't fly into adrenaline-fueled bloodlust whenever a fight breaks out. That's not how uncontrollable bloodlust works. Just ask sharks. Instead, the barbarian must deliberately choose to fly into a rage, and it's down to careful resource management. It's stupid, arbitrary, gamey bullshit, and I will never, ever like it, no matter what dumbass excuse you spew from your noise hole. Abilities that only work a certain number of times per day are game mechanics, and they only work that way because of game balance. And D&D 5e has leaned into that shit hard. Every class has expertise dice, or inspiration dice, or key points, or whatever. Do you know where that shit started? It started with third effing edition. 3E made that shit a staple of class design. Barbarian Rage, Bardic Music, Turn Undead, Wild Shape, Lay on Hands, Smite Evil. That was all 3E. Bull effing shit.